What's up, everybody? It's Shelby with Hooks, Books, and Crime. It's Craft and Story Time, where I craft and tell you a terrible story. If this is something you're into, if you're enjoying this, I really, really strongly ask that you hit that like and subscribe button. Please tell your friends. I'm trying to grow here. I'm going back to my dual screens. I tried something different. I didn't like it. I want to go back. Now, as usual, if you like to craft and listen to true crime, let me be your girl. That's what I'm here for. I too like it. And I want to create a crochet circle vibe around it. There's a lot of us. I just need y'all to come here and hang with me. With that being said, let's get started. On September 24th, 2006, a Polish student in Glasgow goes missing. Her name is Angelika Kluk. She works at a church in the area, St. Patrick's Church. And she's well-liked. She's a very nice girl. She's a good student. Everybody in the community likes her. But she's disappeared and they're very concerned. The last person she was seen with was the church handyman, Pat McLaughlin. And in her disappearance, everybody's like all hands on deck, trying to get the word out, trying to see if she's okay, except for one person. And when police start to, like the first visit of the police coming to investigate her disappearance, this person's like, eh, not bothered by it. But the police keep coming back. They want to ask more questions. They want to search more. And this person just disappears. He's gone. So because of this disappearance, they automatically make him a suspect. Naturally, they put his picture up on the news. Pat McLaughlin, suspect in Angelika Kluk disappearance. But as soon as it goes up, immediately calls start coming in. And that is because that is not Pat McLaughlin. There is no Pat McLaughlin. The picture on the TV is a man named Peter Tobin, who was known and had a history of assaulting and abusing women. So Peter Tobin was born August 27th, 1946, which is eerie because that's when my grandmother was born. However, she's fucking awesome. She's like the coolest. This dude, piece of shit. He was, you know, raised in a big family. He's one of eight children. His dad worked for the local council. His mom was a homemaker. And there's really no reports that these kids were heavily abused. They were heavily neglected. There was some type of emotional abuse dynamic. There is nothing like that. From what it seems, all of them are well adjusted, except Peter. One bad egg out of eight, not bad at all. However, the bad egg is like rotten to the core. So yikes. And Peter proves that he's the problem child pretty early on. He's actually sent to reform school at the age of seven because he keeps committing theft and burglaries. Burglaries at seven. What the fuck is he sneaking into and stealing? That's insane. He goes to the reform school. He comes back. There was no reform. Peter is still committing these acts. It's really habitual and in his nature at this point. The family moves around and literally no matter where they go, it has nothing to do with Peter's surroundings, obviously. Peter's going to do Peter because the behavior just keeps going and it kind of ramps up. He just can't help himself. It's a compulsion. It's a high. Dude's like fucking nosediving down fast. And the thing is, like, Peter does get in trouble. It's not like he was doing all this and never getting caught. He was getting caught. It just, consequence did not affect him. He did not care. It really didn't bother him. Anytime, like, the law would come down on him, completely unfazed. As soon as he's out, he's right back to it. So when Peter's 22, he meets a 17-year-old girl named Margaret. Yikes. They get married in August of 1969, and they move to Brighton. So Brighton is a town in England. It's on the south coast. It looks beautiful, honestly. It's known for its beaches. It has this really cool pier and boardwalk. It's got a lot going on. It's definitely kind of area like, you know, young newlyweds would want to be at. Sounds like a good time. And at first, so what drove Margaret to date and allow herself to be courted by Peter and to marry him? Is Peter was very attentive. He would listen to her. He was gentle. He was always concerned. He was such a charming man that he like swept her off her feet pretty easily. And he's kind of like the ideal partner. They move down to Brighton and all of that is just gone. There's a new Peter in town and it's actually the real Peter that he's been keeping veiled this whole time. Peter was horribly abusive to her, very controlling, controlling to the point where she wasn't allowed to leave the house. And his abuse was all kinds of abuse. I mean, this man was so horrid at one point, he fucking killed her puppy in front of her, which I don't know. I feel like I'd gouge his eyes out. But she's 17. That's terrifying. She probably had no other experience with men to be like, shit, this isn't normal. And she knew this wasn't normal, but she's trapped. He moved her away from her family. She's very young, and if he's not letting her out of the house, she's probably not working. What made him even scarier is that Peter would flip. He'd be so charming, you know, back to the Peter she fell in love with, and just literally like a light switch, this sadistic Peter would come out, and he was a monster again. He cut off all of her access to people, and she really had to try to find her way out. What her way out was Peter actually gets arrested because of some burglaries he had committed, and he gets put in jail and has to serve time. While he's in prison is when Margaret actually goes and files for divorce, and she's able to get away. She moves back home with her family. Peter gets incarcerated in 1971, does a very short stint, and by 1973, he's out and marrying his second wife, Sylvia Jeffrey. Sylvia and Peter actually have two children together. They have a son and they have a daughter. Unfortunately, their daughter passed away quite quickly, which I'm sure was just a horrible impact, even to Peter. As much as an awful man as he is, it's really hard for me to not empathize with someone who loses a child. That's literally, I have nightmares. That's my biggest fear, that and fires. And even at that, you know how sometimes there, you know, there's a monster, and when the woman bears his children, like a softness can kind of come out of him, and suddenly they're still a piece of shit, but like the piece of shittiness has like come down a little bit, dropped a level. Not in this instance. Sylvia faces the same kind of abuse that Margaret did. Same thing of cutting her off access, not wanting her to leave the house. Horrible abuse mentally, physically, and verbally, emotionally. And sure, it's even harder when you have children because you want to keep them safe and you know you're not in a safe environment. So Sylvia starts planning to get out also. Luckily, in 1976, Sylvia is actually able to escape Peter with her son. How? I didn't see, but I'm sure she planned this in secret, which is just terrifying. The fear of getting caught and having that taken away, unimaginable. I'm so glad she got out also. After Sylvia leaves, he's completely unfazed. He goes on about his life, picking up odd jobs, committing crimes. It's really how he supports himself throughout life. And he kind of goes about this way for quite a while, for 13 years. And then he meets his third wife, Kathy. Now, Kathy was only 16 when she met Peter. Okay, and let's do the math here. We're in the 70s plus 13. And Mr. Peter is born in 1946. So if he wasn't enough of a creepy piece of shit, gross man, he just like amped it up a level. She's 16. She's a fucking child. She's 16 and Peter's 40. Their relationship moved very quickly. She moved in with him very quickly. They relocated really quickly to Bathgate, Scotland. And she has a son with him. During this whole period, he is nothing but kind to her. And this is why she has a child with him and she moved with him. He is so doting and charming. He's protective. He's tender. Again, she is completely swept off her feet, just like Sylvia and just like Margaret. But once Kathy marries him, it's almost like, okay, now I don't have to pretend anymore. You're mine. Now you get the real me. That's the vibe I'm getting from this. So Kathy, just like the previous wives, was trapped in her home with her son. She's not allowed to leave. He would even hire people to make sure she doesn't leave the house. And I mean, this man would have, you know, force her to have really rough sex to where she's in pain and she's scared. And if it wasn't her, he would bring home other young women and would make her watch him have really rough, abusive sex at this point. Because I highly doubt these women consented to being fucking bludgeoned in the face while having sex. And she had to watch him do this, which she probably felt so helpless that she can't help herself. She can't even help this girl. That's a whole different level of mental torment, really. Luckily, Kathy found what could get her out. And little by little, she was saving money. She's finally able to save enough for a bus fare for her and her son. And she just hightails it out of there. She never has to see him again. So in 1991, Peter actually moves and back to South England to a town called Margate. And he does this to be closer to a son. And when he's in Margate, like, he's considered a good neighbor. He keeps to himself. He doesn't cause a ruckus. He's not really nosy. And he's not rude either. He keeps to himself, but anytime a neighbor needed help with something or something seemed wrong, he'd offer assistance and would help take care of everything. Really, there were no red flags for these neighbors. But at some point in Margate, he just ups and leaves. He's just gone. And his neighbor was kind of like, all right. He thought it was weird. But again, there was nothing really that nothing that stuck out at him as like, this dude's fucking weird. It was kind of like, eh, he's weird. And it turns out Peter actually moved to another town still on the south coast of England called Havant. He moves there. So on August 4th, 1993, his five-year-old son's there with him. And that evening, two 14-year-old girls actually go to his neighbor's house. They're knocking on his door. However, the friend they're trying to visit is not home. So Peter offers to allow these girls to wait in his flat while their friend gets home. He puts his son to sleep, and then Peter drugs him with amitriptyline. And amitriptyline is a medication used for depression, chronic pain. Its whole purpose is to fucking knock you out, really. That's what it does. And in this case, that's what happens to these girls. They just knock out. They black out from this medication. Once they pass out, he sexually assaults them. And then he actually leaves them for dead. He turns the gas on in his flat and leaves with his son, hoping that they would suffocate before they actually wake up from the dosing. Fortunately, one girl wakes up just in the nick of time, is able to get her friend to wake up. They escape and they run and tell the police what happened. And Peter evades arrest, not for very long. He tries going by the name Peter Wilson, but they catch him. His hideout only lasts for 40 days and he's captured. In 1994, he pleads guilty to rape and assault, and he's sentenced to 10 years. However, so when Pete's released, he actually leaves the area he was in and changes his name to Pat McLaughlin. And he does this to avoid having to do the sex offender registry without him having a reputation. He's really trying to just avoid all of the consequences of his actions. And he actually moves to Glasgow, Scotland. Peter, now Pat, actually at some point like stumbles upon this church. And on this day, the weather conditions are really, really bad. This charity that works with the church offers him some dinner, and the priest offers for Peter to be, or Peter, now Pat, to sleep in the church so he doesn't have to go back and bear those conditions at night. After eating, he can just have a restful sleep. And after this, first Peter starts to work with the charity, doing little odd jobs for them, and he would help the church out as well. Then, like, eventually there's like a transition, and he is solely the handyman of St. Patrick's Church. And really, everybody thinks he's a nice guy. And see, the thing is, Peter grew up Catholic. He was raised Catholic. And it seems like he kind of felt like a safety here. He understands the culture and the behavior, the mannerisms. He kind of knows what's expected of him and what to expect of people. So he's able to blend right in. From, like, I think I saw a bunch of documentaries on this and read a bunch of articles. I only found one person who was in this, you know, involved in this church community at the time that he was there. And I really only heard one person who was just like, everybody liked him but me. There was one person who could see through him. And that's really scary that there's all these people and only one. Because a lot of times everybody's going to be like, what's your problem? Nobody's going to follow the person who sees right through them. You usually need a little bit more to pick it up. And this is the church that he's the handyman at. It's the church that Angelica Klug is the cleaner. And so they would work alongside each other. She would actually help him on some of his jobs. The day she went missing, she was actually helping him in the garage that's attached to the church. The priest was the last one to see them together. He left and they were still working together in the garage. September 24, 2006 is when Angelica Klug is last seen. They know that the last person to see her was Pat McLaughlin. And Pat, like, he talks to the police, he tells them everything. But after like the third visit of the police coming to the church, and it wasn't necessarily that they wanted to talk to him. They wanted to look at everything still. He realizes that more like this is going to come back on him. It's going to lead to him. So he takes off. And as mentioned in the beginning, this puts his face out. And this is when the police learn that they have actually, you know, this church has been duped. They're looking for Peter Tobin. And knowing his history, now they're on high alert and they're very fearful for what's happened to Angelica, knowing what he's capable of. Because of this realization, they search the church again. And they go deep down and really make sure to comb through everything. And that's when they spot something that looks like out of sorts. So they decide to check under the floorboards. This is where they find Angelica Klug. Under fucking floorboards. After the autopsy and analyzing the crime scene, it's believed that once the priest left, I don't know. Okay, I'm going to keep calling him Peter. I wanted to call him Pat, and I'm confusing myself. Peter. Once the priest leaves and Peter knows that they're alone together, He hits her over the head with a chair leg. He binds her hands and her feet, and he sexually assaults her. But not sexually. He doesn't just do that. Like, that's not bad enough. He starts assaulting her and starts beating this poor girl up. She's bound and she's completely defenseless. And then he begins to stab her multiple times. They weren't able to determine if she was already in the floorboards when he stabbed her. But what they do know is this poor girl was put in the floorboards alive, which is just so awful. It's a dark place, and she knows she's in such a spot that nobody's gonna find her. I see that as a form of torture. That's torture. That is a really, really ugly way to mentally torment. And I think that's what he enjoyed. All kinds of abuse, but I think he really enjoyed mental torment. Because who the fuck thinks of stuff like that? Really, who thinks of that? Monsters. Luckily, Peter is actually, he's caught pretty quickly. He actually goes into a hospital under the name, what was his name? Sorry, I gotta check my name. Why do I use small font when I'm old? He checks into this hospital as James Kelly. But one of the hospital staff recognizes him because his face is everywhere. They call authorities. So he's arrested in the hospital and let out. Why he's at the hospital? No clue. Who cares? He should have died there. Well, on May 4th, 2007, Peter is actually found guilty for the murder of Angelica Klug and is sentenced to no less than 21 years, which is a life sentence over there. And he's 60 years old at this point. And in this whole trial, he has no remorse as usual. Remember, like consequence, no effect on him. It's nothing to him. So he shows no remorse. Emotion at all. The only time he shows emotion is when there's like this famous footage of him coming out of the courthouse and he kicks a guy, one of the paparazzi guys, and knocks him over. That's the only time that you see any type of feeling. And it's because everybody's all in his face. And I don't know what would piss him off so bad. Maybe he was overwhelmed. Who knows? Who cares? But that's the only time when he's more concerned with himself, of course. But Peter being sentenced and captured for the murder of Angelica Klug is really just the tip of the iceberg. The detective knows that Angelica is not his first victim. So he gathers a team together to work backwards and see if they can locate possibly another victim of Peter Tobin's, this creating the team Operation Anagram. So the only way that they're able to really work backwards in this is they have to associate missing women with his previous addresses that they have on file. And they stumble across one that they think falls into that criteria. They started with the Bathgate house, and that's when they see a girl named Vicky Hamilton. She's 15 years old. She went missing not too far from that area. She was reported missing February 10th of 1991 and was last seen waiting for a bus. And it had been a cold case since then. And we're in 2007 at this point with the agony. However, they go and search the house that he lived in Bathgate, and they don't find anything. They don't find any sort of evidence that anything nefarious happened on this property. So they move on to the Margate house. So while searching for missing women near the Margate house, 18-year-old Dinah McNichol comes up. And Dinah McNichol went missing August of 1991. And Dinah McNichol and her boyfriend attended a festival called the Lip Book Festival. And they were trying to find a ride home. And according to Dinah's boyfriend, an older man pulled up and offered them a ride home. An older Scottish man is what he said specifically. And we know Peter Tobin is Scottish. So they dropped Dinah's boyfriend off first in Surrey. And Dinah was supposed to be dropped off in Essex, but she never made it home. So they visit Peter's Margate house. And as they're, you know, going through the house, they start canvassing the neighborhood and they speak to his neighbor because it's the same person that lived there when he lived there. They still live next door. And again, this neighbor said there was nothing like specific about Peter that rubbed him the wrong way. He was a weird guy, but there wasn't like these, you know, blaring sirens and just giant red flags. But he did recall one instance. He said one time he heard something. He was in his garden and he heard Peter in his, and that wasn't like Peter. Peter wasn't a gardener. So, you know, he peers over the fence and he sees he's digging a hole. It's a pretty big hole. And he asks him, like, Peter, what are you doing? I'm not going to do the accent. It's like, Peter, what are you doing? Why are you digging this hole? And he explains to him that he's digging this hole for his 5-year-old son. He's going to put a sand pit in there so his son can play. And he's like, oh, okay, cool. You know, and he just left it at that. A few days later, though, he actually looks over the fence again. There is no sand pit. and the holes filled in. So he asks, he's like, what happened? You know, why'd you fill in the hole? And he tells them that it had to do with regulations. Like, basically, he wasn't allowed to have a sand pit in the garden, which the neighborhood was like, well, that's weird. Never heard of that one. But he didn't think too much of it, and he didn't look further into it. Didn't seem like a big deal to him. Most of us would just be like, eh, whatever, okay. But hearing this, there's no, like, we need to check the backyard. So they start excavating the garden. And they have, you know, those machines that you kind of go over the land to see if there's any, like, bodies or anything under the ground. And they hit on something. Within 24 hours of them digging and excavating the garden, they locate 15-year-old Vicky Hamilton. She's 450 miles away from where she was last seen. Because they find Vicky, they continue digging. On December 16th, Dinah McNichol is found. Peter's fingerprints are all over the tarp that is wrapped around the girls that they're buried with. After an autopsy is performed, they both have traces of amitriptyline in their system. Good God. Amitriptyline in their system. There. So, and at this point, that's kind of like his MO, I would say, because that's what he did to the two girls. So Peter received a 30-year sentence for Vicky Hamilton. And on December 16th, 2009, one day before my 19th birthday, he receives another life sentence for Dinah's murder. So after this, they like interview Peter, and he claims that he's murdered 48 women. And he's very boastful about it and very arrogant, because he'll tell them this, but he will not assist in locating these girls at all. Doesn't even drop like the slightest hint. Investigators believe this to be true, or at least to be partially true. They definitely feel there's more than just two that they're looking for. And it's really hard to believe that he would take a break, you know, for 10 years and then start murdering again. Usually you age out of murder. You don't take a gap, you know, you don't go on a hiatus for 10 years. Like, no, that just doesn't happen. However, Operation Anagram was unable to locate any more victims. They weren't able, anything that they could kind of tie together, it always fell through. And in 2011, Operation Anagram is dissolved. So Peter Tobin died on my man's birthday, October 8th, 2022. I assume a small consolation for all of the people that his actions impacted. Angelica Klug's parents trusted the world with their daughter. And they trusted their daughter enough to let go and allow her to go to another country and study. A lot of states, a lot of people struggle with their kids going to just a different city for college. She's in a foreign country. She was a good girl. She didn't do anything wrong. She didn't put herself in a position only to meet her demise in a fucking church. I have nothing against churches. I never blame the church and blame the people who look at the church as a way to abuse power. That's what it is. It's never the church, it's the fucking people for the most part. But I think that that coincidence would eat at me. But if you're religious, I guess you could also see it that she was in the Lord's house when she went. It's a really hard way to process that, I feel. Just like any type of loss, especially when they're taken from you unnaturally. And then there's Dinah and Vicky's families. They waited 15 years for an answer. That is double Vicky's lifetime, nearly double Dinah's lifetime. That family had to lie in wait 15 birthdays. And we don't know what their relationship was with their family at that time. You hear so many people of like, I was mad at them, we got in a fight, and I was mad at them, and then they passed away. I would really hope that's not the situation here, because I can't imagine. You already have the pain of not knowing, the fear of not knowing, the worry of not knowing, and then you mix in some type of conflict that has to fester for 15 years because someone just can't fucking control their impulses and is just sick in the head. The agony I feel thinking about that is already so palpable, I couldn't imagine living through it. And then you think of Dinah's boyfriend. Imagine the guilt that poor kid felt, and possibly even the judgment he felt of allowing Dinah to ride with this man to go home. I have no doubt that that kid, or that, I don't know, yeah, if he's like around her age, you're still a kid, technically. That kid probably had nightmares, possibly PTSD. I don't know if that's considered survivor's guilt, but there's a guilt there. And I hope that's brought him some peace as well. And what do we do with this information, right? What can we learn and what can we grasp from this? Because it has to mean something, right? And the only thing I can think of really in this case is we need to be aware and we need to be vigilant. Luckily, in this day and age, you know, you have My Favorite Murder saying, fuck politeness and go with your gut, which, I mean, that made me feel better because I was always considered a bitch because I always went with my gut. And if you gave me a bad vibe, too fucking bad. Sorry. We have that openness now where if we can be that way and, you know, we can just apologize for it and people will understand. We have to be vigilant. We have to be aware. We have to be grateful that he was captured and that his ex-wives were willing to offer their testimony to help find him, and that this man was taken off the streets and he can't hurt anybody else. We have to be grateful for even that little shed of light at the end. And of course, there's a light of these girls finally being returned to their families and resting peacefully. But that is the story of the horrible, horrible man, Peter Tobin. I thank you for joining me today. Again, if you enjoyed this, please hit that like button, subscribe, tell a friend, but I'll catch you on the next one. Okay, bye.